This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. You could also be listening, if you didn't know this, Stefan.
I didn't.
You could also be listening on our wonderful podcast, which has bonus content. You could also be listening via one of our very appreciated partners, such as our international array of syndicates, or on Rabble.ca. Pretty good list,
yeah.
Just in case you didn't know.
Yes, I every week I relearn that fact, and every week I'm excited.
It's amazing every day. It's like Christmas every Friday.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
I just love the word international. I feel like it's probably like one radio station in Colorado, but I still love it.
Yeah, it's like the 100% beef thing.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so I'm your host, Darren Kaster, back here in the host seat, more or less as usual now again after an extended hiatus. If you're curious about that, we talked about it last week in the bonus show. And other than that, we're just going to move on.
All right, let's do this.
So, Stefan, it's currently just you and me. We may actually have some other people joining us, and we have a canned person joining us. Let me just quickly tease that, and then we're going to get to the news. You're going to walk us through some news. I'm going to comment on it. We're going to have a pre-record, which I will talk about now, and then we actually have some comments that are sort of going to tie into some of the global events, including the horrific terrorist act in the U.S. here, which will be related somewhat, and somewhat is just us feeling like we feel obliged, like we have to say something. So this will be a very all-over-the-place show today. The interview, which we're going to do in the second part before we get to our news, is actually with a bit of a Toronto... I don't know if legend is the right word, but I remember being in my parents' car listening to music, and Chum FM is pretty much the among other things the standard in most parents' cars, and pretty much a guarantee in 95% of office buildings here in Toronto. So for those of you who don't live in Toronto, Chum FM is essentially, if you have a local station that basically plays music that mostly is played in like most people's offices, so like things that are most likely to please all ages. Sort of stuff. That's kind of Trauma FM here in Toronto, and I was got an award thanks to your recommendation here at Volunteer Toronto a little while ago, and the host was Ingrid Schumacher, who's been essentially the voice of Toronto's one of Toronto's biggest music stations for about 40 years now, and so I got an opportunity to meet her and we chatted, and I just really wanted to talk to her. So as somebody who's been sort of like communicating with Toronto and it's in a little bit of a lighter context because she's a music host, but at the same point has also just been sort of here as very visible and talking about Toronto for 40 years, I think has a very unique perspective. So we did actually catch up with her a little bit after that. I was able to connect with her, and so we have a brief chat with her about her perspective about how Toronto has changed over time from the point of view of somebody with a massive, both metaphorical and literal, microphone here in Toronto. So we'll do that in the second half for a little bit of a break between two somewhat heavy sections, which we're going to start with now, Stefan.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. So interesting. So the news, it's always funny when specific actions sort of dominate the news cycle. And so a lot of what we would normally cover on the Rut Environment Show get pushed to the back of news cycles because they aren't the thing. But at the same time, there's still three stories this evening. I want to start with the one that I think is actually the biggest news, and it's a funny topic, I think, in part because we're often, I don't know how to feel when my biases are right. Whenever my biases are confirmed, I'm always sort of like, should I go and try to find another thing that says no, or should I just be like, yes, this is actually happening?
I was going to say, if you're finding your biases being confirmed, you're probably on Facebook.
That's a good point. Yeah. So this is one of those things that really does feed into the collective bias of the environmentalist left, and so whether or not. But at the same time, it really did happen. Yeah. It's all about Peabody Energy, one of the largest coal company in the United States, just declared bankruptcy. I think we actually talked about this a couple weeks ago.
We did.
But what's interesting about when you declare bankruptcy is that you have to then open your books and reveal everything that happened, that sort of what was going on inside the company as a part of this declaring bankruptcy. You have to basically prove you don't have the money, so you then have to show courts and then the public record where your money went to some degree. And in doing this, it was revealed that Peabody Energy was not just sort of, you know, doing the sort of a typical funding, say, one small group of climate denial, or was any, you know, was just, you know, was maybe supporting right-wing think tanks, which would then do stuff. No, Peabody Energy was a part of a large, broad list of climate denial. And it sort of went the gamut of different ways you can deny, different ways you can sort of push the politics of denial, so much so that Kurt Davies, who's the founder of the Climate Investigation Center, and he spent the last 20 years tracking funding on climate denial, called this the broadest list I have seen for one company funding so many nodes in the denial machine. So they were at the heart of this kind of deal. And then he goes on earlier in that same quote, he says that these groups collectively are the heart and soul of climate denial. And so here's a coal company being directly tied to what is being called the heart and soul of climate denial. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, this, I guess, shouldn't be that surprising because, you know, businesses are supposed to look out for business interests, and their business interest was to definitely have the public not know about climate change. However, in a much broader what's good for society context, or even in actuality, you know, what with like Exxon knew, in which the Exxon knew about climate change for 30, 40 years and then funded denial. It's incredibly immoral, but it's also illegal to try to convince the public something you know is incorrect. You can't. It's false. You know, false advertising, quote unquote. I think it's the breadth of their actions here that is more newsworthy than the fact that they were doing it. Mm. So what's interesting about this as well is that there's not only was it sort of just when I mentioned that it was sort of the breadth even goes as far as to actually have specific scientists named as money came out. So Richard Lindzen and Willie Soon.
Willie Soon is what we've spoken about repeatedly. It's not a super memorable name, but he is a very well funded gentleman who's been responsible for he's been involved in hundreds of papers. Like, he's the go to name for if you need somebody with a degree to sign your climate nonsense. He'll do it for money.
Well, exactly. So what's interesting is that these like this is why when people say 97, it's like, well, it's not 100%. We're not funding. The fact that you have a coal giant directly being revealed to be funding these contrarian scientists.
Yeah.
When your last 3% of scientists are all receiving direct money from you know, coal barons,
right.
You can understand at least why some of us might be skeptical.
Well, and that brings me back a perfect opportunity to say my number again. Most people have heard these numbers, but many people say them wrong. Like, they phrase it wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't get the technical accuracy of it right. But I think when you do it accurately, I think it's even more telling about the thing you were just saying, which was there's two numbers people throw around. There's a 97% number and there's a 99% number. They're talking about two different things. 97% is the amount of peer-reviewed research that falls under climate that essentially agrees that it's human-caused and a concern. So 3% claims that it is either not human-caused or questions that it's human-caused or questions that it's a concern, even if it is human-caused or even if it is real or questions its legitimacy. 99% is the number of scientists. So mm-hmm. If you can do the math there, 1% of scientists are responsible for 3% of the research, which it sounds like two very small numbers. But that means that basically a very tiny portion of people like Mr. Soon have been prolific in writing papers well beyond the average. It's the squeaky wheel gets the grease things. The people who are on the shakiest ground are screaming and kicking their legs wildly as loud as possible, and it makes their side seem disproportionate.
Mm-hmm. And there's a Canadian tie-in to this as well, actually, mm-hmm. I want to flash back about 2 years-ish now when the Harper government trademark was – was going all against the fact that these foreign funded environmentalists were attacking Canadian sovereignty. So it turns out that one of the people that the that the Peabody, the United States, the largest coal thing, was funding was the Calgary-based Friends of Science Society. This comes out of the National Observer, and it's, of course, you know.
Have you heard a more workshopped name of an organization?
Yeah, Friends of Science. I think Friends of Science comes to me the same under anything that has the word taxpayers in it. I'm just like, if you're the friend of the taxpayers, I'm already kind of like, the word friend alone, I'm kind of concerned by in a organizational title.
That's right up there with like Allies of Citizens or Allies of Patriots, suspicious titles for organizations.
Yes, exactly. I don't necessarily think that whether or not a quote unquote foreign, like I think that's kind of endorsing this sort of protectionism that I always think is kind of silly, especially in this sort of small sense. But I do find it highlighting is a dichotomy between the attacks on sort of foreign funded environmental groups and the down home nature of the oil sands and climate denial in Canada, which is ludicrous in so many ways. You'd go through the numbers of who owns the oil sands. You'd go through the numbers of of who is funding Friends of Science Society.
In our modern 2016 economy, the idea of calling anything either local or international is just like those words don't mean anything anymore. We have a completely globalized economy.
Yeah,
The oil we produce doesn't go to us. Yeah. Right. So and the same thing with Donald Trump talking about, homegrown oil independence. It's not your oil. It's the oil company's oil, and they're international companies. They might be based in America, so they get to call themselves, with scare quotes around it, American companies. But the borders are irrelevant. These are completely irrelevant. First of all, we have a global problem we need to deal with at a global level. But second of all, there's no such thing as like a Canadian company, not in a modern economy, not when you were talking about things like oil companies. Sure. Mom and pop store down the street. Fine. You want to call that local? Great. Exxon, is not an American company.
Yeah.
That's just not the, like, those words cease to mean anything if you're going to use them that way.
A good friend of mine was telling me a story recently about how, I believe it was Heinz Ketchup was going to move one of their factories out of Southern Ontario or somewhere in Ontario into the States. And then it caused a massive uproar in the areas because they weren't going to buy Heinz Ketchup anymore. And so a different ketchup company, multinational ketchup company, decided to take over that store and create their own stuff, and everyone switched dramatically to buy this other multinational's ketchup, and this was the power of local movements,
right?
which as far as those I'm sure working at the ketchup factory were very stoked about it. It's still kind of silly,
right? So running out of time here, I want to move on. There's two really quick points I want to make about this story. There's two, I think, two important takeaways. Firstly, let's go with the fun one. The fun one is, here's a company who denied reality so much that they paid others to deny reality. And instead of spending money investing in their business to deal and negotiate and lower the risk threshold for their company, decided instead to spend all of their money on pretending reality wasn't reality and trying to convince others it wasn't either. They're now bankrupt. And metaphorically speaking, we are going to put their head on a stake and leave it at the city gates. This is the rest of you guys in 2 to 5 to 10 to 15 years if you don't sort it out. Let this be a warning to you. Second of all, this is a massive indication. So we have two things. There's the Exxon New thing, and now there's this analysis with Peabody Energy. We have a situation here where pretty much every major company does this. This is standard operating procedure, is to fund denial of reality to further your business interests. Now, sometimes people's business interests are furthered by reality, for instance, solar companies. But this is a massive problem. So I just wish that people would stop being shocked. This is how business is done. This is not like some aberrant. It's not like we found out that Peabody Energy was like, had a secret slave camp on the moon. This is standard operating procedure. Who's surprised? Like, let's hurry up and, first of all, let's learn this and let's stop being surprised. Second of all, when I go on my long tirades about, how we need to fundamentally reshape the way our global economy works and the way our global power structure works, and you roll your eyes, this is what This is why I'm talking about it. And the fact that you don't acknowledge that there are these sorts of critical problems is why when I suggest these things, it seems either silly, unnecessary, or, you know, pie in the sky. It's not because they are, in fact, pie in the sky. It's because that you, and this is a theoretical you, of course, I'm not necessarily talking to any specific listener or any listener necessarily, but it's because they are simply ignorant of the real gravity, the real, like, how deep this sickness has gone into our system. As opposed to the person proposing a solution being out to lunch.
Yeah. I think there's a pretty good sum up of that story. So moving on to other ways people can go bankrupt. The Catholic is not the whole – unfortunately, it's not all of Catholicism, but it's the first step, which is great, is that there are four I want to say dioceses, organizations, Australian Catholic organizations have announced that they're completely divesting from coal, oil, and gas in what they are saying is the first joint Catholic divestment anywhere in the world. And it doesn't see it's not a ton of money. These aren't these massive parts of it,
right?
But it's a first step in what and it's an obvious reaction from what the Pope's messaging last year.
Right.
You know, when the Pope had that messaging out last year, it was highlighted as groundbreaking, and then it faded off. You know, it didn't really make the news again. Didn't really necessarily know what happened. I think here is an example, a more direct example of that coming to roost. And what's interesting about it, of course, is that it's a faith based piece. It's really coming from morality. It's coming from they are seeing it as a moral obligation to divest. And if this catches on through the rest of the world's billion or so Catholics, you're talking about a lot of money moving away from fossil fuels. And it's interesting in the article in The Guardian, which we'll post, of course, they mentioned that it used to be when you were trying to get these organizations together, you would have kind of a priest saying, oh, it's not really, we don't want to get political. It's not really our place to do this. But now that the Pope has come down and be like, this is a thing we have to do, that argument is completely gone. You know,
which if they weren't doing something I like, I would give them a hard time about the
right.
A church doesn't want to be political, but you know what? This time we'll let it pass. We'll let that. I will not make fun of them for that.
All right, time. Thank you, Darren. And so this is one of those things where it's sort of like I think it's a little blip of something to watch if it catches on. If it's just four of these small Australian Catholic organizations, not necessarily the amount of money moved is inconsequential. But if it's a turning of the tide, it could really mean something.
Yeah, and I think stuff like this is going to be more and less impactful in different places. Of course, despite my just previous comments just a moment ago about global economy and all that stuff, it still doesn't mean that there aren't differences in each local area. Of course there are. And I think in this case, Australia is interesting because they've repeatedly proposed some, I don't know if significant is the right word, but tangible, at least, climate policies. And then they keep getting rolled back by the next government or somebody goes back on their promise or whatever. So Australia is, of course, a huge contributor to a lot of these problems because of their business, because of the business side there. So it's just really interesting where in this case where – there's obviously an appetite for and a demand because of the impact that Australia has on emissions to do stuff, but it's never really taken root. And every time they move forward one step and then they go back a step and a half and then they take two steps forward and then a step back. Is that I think in other areas where it may not, this type of sort of like ethics appeal and religion appeal that sort of cuts underneath, I think, to a certain degree, and for better or worse, goes around sort of the sort of rhetoric conversation and just goes, according to our church, this is immoral. I think this might be potentially more useful and more significant in Australia than it may be in other places. Mm.
And I think the other thing about regionalism, at least in Australia, is that they have actually an immediate and very tangible example of climate change in ocean acidification impacting the coral reef. Mm-hmm. And so the Great Barrier Reef is this sort of like, it's a big warning bell. Every time the bleaching gets too bad, it's a it's it's a very obvious site specific thing, which you can see is being danger and hurt, and it's a big part of their also their over collective identity. Yeah. And so as far as places that have like a really obvious thing they can see in climate change, Australia is really big on that. Mm-hmm. Moving on to our third story before we get to the break, it's one of those stories that I think is. I always find the ones that start with secret briefings. Whenever a story starts with secret briefings, I'm always interested.
Ooh.
Because, like, you know, I guess in part it's because when you're the government, if you say anything at all, it's a story. And so, like, I feel like I would be interested about how many secret briefings are that go through the government that are actually just, you know, like this one, are just straight talk that the people would love to hear, but, you know, they aren't going to start, they can't start throwing around all the stuff because then they have to do things about them, shockingly.
Yeah. Just a super quick aside about American political leaks. These are almost exclusively done intentionally by the current administration. And one piece of evidence for that was when they have a leak that they didn't like, Snowden.
Right.
Like that's what happens when there's an actual leak that wasn't supposed to get leaked and people get pissed off. If there's a leak that happens to make the government look good, it's 1,000,000% that, like, it happens all the time. I'm not even being conspiratorial. This is like standard operating procedure. If you can't do a press release about something because it's, you know, it would look bad if the president was to come out and gloat about it, they just leak it to the press.
Right.
So just so the people have the proper context for what we mean by leaks here. If this was actually a secret, like, ooh, we didn't want this out, they'd be hunting that person to the end of the earth right now.
Well, again, but this is what's interesting about this I'd be curious. I don't actually know how it doesn't necessarily say how it came out, but it's interesting. What it is a briefing to Canada's Indigenous Affairs Minister, which warns that disasters are increasing in number and severity, and disproportionately affecting remote and reserve communities. So the first half of that quote unquote secret briefing is just saying climate science. You know, dangerous natural disasters are increasing. We've been saying that on the show for the last 507 episodes. I'm pretty sure. I wouldn't be surprised if Jordan Popping, the original host, opened the very first thing saying, "Due to climate change, natural disasters are increasing." But the second half, I think, is what is interesting, and the way it's framed. Even this is the National Post, and it's framed in this fact that it's really impacting Indigenous peoples first and foremost. And you see it all over the place. You see it, you know, in Fort McMurray is an example of a remote community that's sort of going to be getting helped. But can you imagine these forest fires are raging all the time. Every year there are forest fires. And every year there are these people who are living in these remote communities who are being affected by it, who don't have the microphone to be heard, especially these Indigenous communities. And so it's one of those things where it's when anyone asks, I think, or whenever it seems like the reason why, or part of the reason why Indigenous people are such powerful spokespeople for the climate change and for these issues is because they're the ones being impacted first, and they know it, and so they are, there's a power that comes from a desired justice that doesn't necessarily come through when you're just sort of like, I know I'll be fine, but I think I should care about this, versus this is impacting me now, I see it, and it's racist that you're not doing something about it.
Right.
We'll post this as well, and it's really just it's one of those things where it's natural disasters are happening more increasingly, and in part of they're happening more often in remote communities. And because they're closer to some of these nature things, especially wildfires. So what's interesting is that they're focusing on reserve. In a document comparing 118 incidents in 2011 and 2012 to 76 in 2010 and 2011, and then 54 before that. So this is going from 54 to 76 to 118 in an incredibly short time span.
Yeah.
And between 2009 and 2015, 480 natural hazards affected reserves. If 480 natural disasters impacted Toronto in the last 6 years, this would be a thing we would be dealing with. Of course, this is all over Canada, and so it's not like they can be one thing. But it speaks to sort of the need for action, and B, the fact you can never forget about environmental justice sort of having to lead the way in the charge for actually taking this kind of action.
Yeah, and I think just before we go to the break, I think the final comment on that will be, or my only comment on that will be, is it any wonder why we have an issue with trust between First Nations communities in Canada and the rest of the country, essentially, you know, specifically the government, but also, you know, any power agency and you know, such a big sort of trust gap, is that it's one of these things where, you know, in addition to everything else, and I'm sure there's people who can come on and do several shows in a row of lectures about other issues, but just sort of as one other coin on top of the pile, is this like one of those things where if you come like, hey, you know, my house is on fire, and the fire department is like, eh,
yeah,
and they don't come. The second time you call, they send police to tell you to stop calling the fire department. The third time, you know, they come and they you know, make fun of you and like help spread the fire and, you know, tell them. And the fourth time, you know, they say that this is, you know, super, it's reverse racism. And then the fifth time they're like, oh my God, the fire department goes, oh my God, my house is on fire. And they're like, we've been telling you,
right?
Like, it's this thing where, like, you know, people, it's this distrust and this dismissal and this whatever. And like, it's not even a matter of the, like, you know, a community needs help, A, but also what's happening to them is about to happen to everybody else. So if you don't care about it when it happens, do you not understand that by not helping them, you're making it worse for yourself too? Like, if that's the lowest possible reason, besides just having a basic shred of human decency and not being a racist, is that maybe this problem in 5 seconds is going to affect you too. Like, it's just mind numbing. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely undeniable that among many other controlling factors here, that just there's just one word to sum it up, and that's racism. Yeah. So let's go to a music break on that. We're going to come back with a little bit of a lighter tone.
I would argue dramatically lighter.
Dramatic lighter. Yeah. Yes, I have a thing for understatement. So a dramatically lighter tone. We're actually going to chat with, as I mentioned earlier, somewhat of a local celebrity here, just in the voice of extremely popular radio station, Ingrid Schumacher from Chum FM, is going to join us just for a brief, very light chat in the middle of the show, and then we'll go back to some more serious stuff at the end of the program. But for now, you're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, Canada's Environment News Program. We're going to be right back after we hear from Alex. What are we going to listen to, buddy? All right. You woke me up there, Alex. You woke me up. All right, you're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to go right now into a pre-recorded interview I did with Ingrid Schumacher, who is one of the music hosts on a extremely popular local Toronto radio station here for about 40 years. So I do apologize some of our non-Toronto listeners. We're going to gush about Toronto just for a few minutes here. But she's absolutely lovely, and it was my pleasure to speak to her about some of her perspective as sort of the in a way, the voice of Toronto, really, for the past, you know, 40 years, in a way. About some of the changes she's seen to the city and about sort of just the idea of environmentalism a little bit. So without further ado, here is Ingrid Schumacher. In studio today with Ingrid Schumacher, who has been on a Chum FM for 39 years, I believe.
Know. Crazy, huh?
On Chum FM doing a music programming. And the reason we're speaking to her today, well, is twofold. The most immediate reason was that I actually met you at an award ceremony recently.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. It was wonderful to be asked to be a part of that evening for Volunteer Toronto, and I got to meet some very interesting people, yourself included.
Well, so thank you very much.
That's how we've connected.
I want to talk to you about a couple of sort of not super serious, but sort of more serious-ish things at the end, because I'm very interested to know what it's like. You've been working at a commercial radio station for quite some time, and so I'd love to ask you a little bit about that. But first, let's talk more just about you. You're a Toronto native. You've been working here in Toronto for quite some time. I believe you were born in Toronto.
I'm actually from Sudbury,
Sudbury,
Ontario.
We won't hold that against you.
Okay. Now be careful. So I'm very proud of Sudbury. And in terms of green, there's really no better place in Ontario. It's wonderful up there.
Awesome. So let's start with that. I mean, you've commented a little bit about your pride in Toronto's greenness, and very happy with Sudbury. So what does that mean to you? What do you like about your city, and what is green about it that makes you prideful?
There are so many things to love about Toronto. Any of us who live here know how lucky we are, fortunate to live here. But from a green standpoint, one only has to bring someone who is not familiar with Toronto up to the top of the Manulife or the CN Tower to physically see how green this city is. It's just a canopy of trees and gardens. And as a gardener myself, this is my favorite time of year. My head's just spinning pretty much from May until, you know, July, when things start to get real hot. So from a green standpoint, in terms of physical green, it's a beautiful city. There's a lot of green here. There's a lot of park space. There are a lot of, you know, things that are of that nature. In terms of green in beyond just the physical, it's becoming more and more green all the time. So, yeah, I've lived in Toronto for close to 40 years now. There were no bike lanes when I moved here. Actually, gas stations weren't even open on Sundays when I first moved here. And you'd be hard-pressed to actually find a restaurant open. But so things like bike lanes and things that, you know, promote green living now for most of us, options and how you're going to get around and things like that. Even transit, yes, the TTC was in existence, but it was very limited. So you had a lot of people living in the burbs, which was, you know, back then that was what everyone did. They left the core of the city, they moved to the suburbs, they had their families, and they got to work in their car. They took their car to work, and it was a non-gas efficient car as well. It was a big car that, you know, used a lot of gas in an infrastructure that really wasn't set up for as many people who eventually, you know, started to land in those burbs. So from a green standpoint, our city is much more green, trust me, than it ever has been. And I'm looking forward to the next levels of that when people start talking about electric cars. That's just so amazing to me. And that it's predicted that, you know, by the time you're about my age, Darren, the tipping point will have happened and more people will have electric than non-electric. It'll just be, you know, why would you buy anything else? Mm-hmm. So that's really exciting from a green standpoint, not only in our city, but across the country and around the world.
I'm wondering if you see it as something as a direct consequence of, like, you know, the hard-fought activism of a bunch of, you know, diehard environmentalists like me, or do you just see this as the natural evolution of the culture of the city of Toronto that was always here, and this is just the 2016 version of
it? I think it's multi-layered. I think there are a lot of things at play here at the same time. A lot of change would not have happened without people like yourself that are promoting that kind of change. Bringing awareness to people is a major part. Education, right? Mm. So yes, that's very important. Government also has to be involved because a lot of these changes are implemented through a city government or a provincial government or a federal government. So these sorts of things, it can't just be activists saying, hey, we should be doing this because this is better for the environment. It largely is going to fall on deaf ears, depending on which level of government perhaps you're trying to get the attention of. However, if you're actively engaging your own community, the entire city, there's a lot of power in that. So, you know, it's multi-level, that there's a lot of different layers and a lot of things at play. I think that as a city, Toronto has become more of a world city on a lot of levels, not just in its green initiatives, certainly, but in a lot of different ways. So those things are all kind of hand in hand, because I think that the same type of educated artistic minds that bring a lot of that to the fore also have, whether they know it even consciously, an environmental objective, even if it's a small one.
It sounds like, and I think this is very true, was that it's more Canada or Toronto has grown up in a certain way and it has changed. But I think you were correct to identify that it was less about it growing into a more environment-oriented city and more that it was in growing into a more world city.
Correct.
And that with that world city status comes more awareness of what do we look like.
They go hand in hand. They go hand in hand around the world. Other city examples around the world have shown us that with their own histories and their own progress. So yes, those sorts of things are inevitable when a city grows, that the proper kind of growth is going to happen. But it goes beyond that, you know. And yes, Toronto is a great green city on a lot of levels, but it's not as green as it could be. Considering what we have here, not only resources-wise, but, you know, finances to a degree, political leadership, all of these things, this city could be a lot more in terms of its own green objective than it is. Certainly. And I look forward to those changes happening because I think they will happen.
Yeah. And I think a little bit of that world city pride is a good thing. I think a little bit of a taste of it is a good thing because it means when you get criticized for things you could improve on, you actually want to improve them because you have pride in your city.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I think a little bit of city pride has its limits, but I think it's useful.
Oh, it's completely useful, even on a very small scale. If the lady down the street from me has pride in her property and is sweeping up or is cleaning garbage out of the alley or whatever, that's a very small green initiative. She doesn't even realize that that's what that is, but that's what that is. And if you have pride in your community, in your home, those things just unfold without anyone having to tell you that you should be doing, you know. So it happens.
something we almost never, and I've been occasionally criticized for it, but it's just not something that's on my personal radar. And, you know, I'm the host of the show generally, so just because of that, it doesn't come up very often, which is we almost never talk about animals. We did do an episode on veganism a few weeks ago where mm-hmm. we really dived in, did a deep dive on that issue. Mm-hmm. And in that conversation, the idea that many people, not all, but many people come to veganism through an appreciation for animal cruelty or you know, appreciation for the issue of animal cruelty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would like to know sort of where that comes from you, not necessarily so much about the vegan thing, but tell me about your sort of your interest in caring for animals.
I'm not a vegan. I'll say that right out. And I'm not even a vegetarian. However, I do have, I think, a clear love and appreciation for animals. I won't tolerate animal cruelty. I won't tolerate all sorts of activity around animals and around animal husbandry, perhaps. So I'm very picky about the food that I do eat that involves animals. And I think there is, personally for me, a healthy, smart way of doing that with a bit of education and kind of looking into things. It's limited. I know, you know, grocery stores aren't exactly going to be telling you the truth about everything, unfortunately, and that's life. And if you choose to eat meat, I think you have to know that you know, that sort of thing may be part of an agenda, a hidden agenda, perhaps, if that's what you think that is happening. In terms of my own interest in animals, you know, it's less about them being in or out of the food chain and more as a respect for animals, basically.
Mm. I've often wondered about that because I've never had a pet personally. I don't have any problem with pets. Obviously, I'm not like afraid of dogs or anything like that. Well, really big dogs, I think most people are afraid of. But,
yeah.
You know, so it's not about that. But I grew up petless. I didn't have a fish or anything when I was a kid. And so I'm not used to having them around. But as somebody who isn't a quote unquote pet person, which I would say I'm not because I don't have one, so I can't be. I've always found it very interesting that there doesn't necessarily seem to be a correlation between pet owners and environmentalism. And I sort of assumed, you know, in my ignorance that there would be, because it's sort of a very intimate connection with nature to have a very, especially with things like dogs, specifically cats to a lesser extent.
I believe there is a connection. I do believe there is a connection because, and I don't own a dog myself, but I, you know many people who do. And when you own a dog, the first thing you have to know is that you're going outside at least 3 times or 4 times every day, even more if your dog can talk you into it. So, and you know, so you're outside, you're walking in your neighborhood, you're in a park, you're on the sidewalk, you're wherever, you're experiencing with your dog your community. And isn't that a nice thing? That's better than being in the house and watching Netflix, in my opinion, okay? Mm-hmm. So, and then you all of a sudden meet up with other people who are like-minded. There's another person with a dog. And dog people all, you know, they'll all acknowledge this. They all know each other. They all talk to each other. They sometimes even end up being friends and socializing together. But bottom line is they all kind of end up congregating in areas and going, hey, what's your dog's name? And what kind of dog is that? And so I think that it does bring out social health in people, as well as environmental responsibility, because people, I don't notice it. I live downtown here, and I really don't notice dog messes anywhere that much. I can't really say I do, because I think people are very responsible about their dogs.
I think there may be less. I think people are less conscious about that correlation. For instance, the reason it popped into my head was just that once that I remember a very ironic or seeming to me to be ironic conversation I had with somebody while they were stopped. It was a stranger who was stopped with their dog,
right?
You know, and for some reason something about acid rain came up or whatever in this very brief passing conversation with a stranger.
Uh-huh.
And they were something about, oh, who cares about damn tree frogs or something like that. And I was looking at them with their pet and be like, I bet if I said, you know, dogs as opposed to tree frogs, you'd get you'd care
absolutely
a lot really fast.
It could be a little polarizing there right off the.
So I think I think it serves as an environment connection, as in you're right. It gets people out into nature,
it does.
I think they do have a connection with animals, and just sometimes I worry that it doesn't carry to other areas where it might be. Wish it did, maybe.
Yes, absolutely, and you're right, absolutely. A lot of people who like dogs maybe don't care about the environment. They don't see it as a correlation. They don't see that the things that living creatures on the earth are all connected, us included, with other things that are living that maybe, you know, aren't people or animals. Mm. So we are all connected, whether you like it or not. But, you know, how people choose to allow that connection to be a part of their own lives is, you know, is personal. And there's some education that needs to be done there for sure.
Mm-hmm. So the last thing that I wanted to talk to you about, Ingrid, as well, again, thank you for joining us. We're speaking for just
You're most welcome. It's so nice to be here with you today, actually.
Ingrid Schumacher from CHEM FM and a voice that many people will recognize
thank you.
Right off the bat. I'm certain of it. So, you know, we're here at a community radio station, you know, more or less as long as we don't break CRTC rules, we get to do whatever we
sure,
want.
Sure, yeah.
So I decide my own programming. I decide to talk about what I want and when I want. And I'm sort mm-hmm. of wondering, what is it, sort of the experience when we're talking about global, very serious issues like climate change and giant fires and mm-hmm. oil spills mm-hmm. and all these urgent issues that affect everybody. Do you feel like there's any sort of maybe more passive than active, but any sort of censorship control or anything like that when you're in a mainstream
situation?
No.
You know, I think that the people, my employers are concerned that I convey my show basically around the mandate of CHEM FM. We are primarily a music station. We're not a news station. Mm. We play music. That's what we do. But wrapped up in the music are the personalities that are on the air, like myself and my coworkers. So that all has to work in tandem. So knowing that, and they fully understand and appreciate it, thankfully, they understand that Ingrid, I come with my own set of beliefs and things that I like and things that I don't like and all of these things that interest me and things that do not. So those things are also incorporated in my show, not in a huge direct way, but many of my listeners, people who listen to me on a regular basis, know that I like animals, know that I ride my bike to work, provided the weather's mostly decent. I know I'm a little bit wimpy. I admit it. I'm the first to admit it. That I have, you know, that I have empathy and compassion for people. I did talk about the Alberta fires on the air. Today I talked about Gordie Howe passing away. So things that mean a lot to me. I talked about Gord Downie the day that the Tragically Hip made the announcement. So those are things that, you know, yeah, it's not about Taylor Swift and Rihanna all the time. It can be about things that are happening in our community. Mm-hmm. Today I talked about the fact that it was Ontario Craft Brew Week starting today, or Summerlicious is starting pretty soon, or I also mentioned that there's a festival in Roncesvalles Village tomorrow, and the Burlington Festival of Sound starts tomorrow, a big music festival. So I do have some freedom in terms of what I'm going to talk about. I can't go on at great length. I'm jealous of you, Darren, to be able just to kind of talk about stuff.
I know. You seem shocked that we even had 15 minutes to talk.
I know,
because
it was like, oh, wow, 15 minutes is amazing. I generally, you know, my boss wants me to keep my chat down below a minute, probably 45 seconds. He's really very happy if I go 30. Mm. So 30 to 45 seconds. So my greatest challenge in that time frame, it's very small, is to be able to say something in a concise, intelligent, you know, way that my listeners are going to be able to relate to without tuning out or without thinking, I didn't get enough information. I don't know what she's talking about. So there, I'm not going to tackle a huge issue. And again, we're not a news station. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I may not talk about, you know, certain issues that are happening around the world necessarily. But we have other things at our disposal. I have Twitter. I have Facebook. So I can spend more time, for instance, on Facebook by posting a link to one of our news stations or whatever when I want to talk about a certain issue. Mm-hmm. And that allows me a bit more freedom. And it allows people to kind of look at it and go, oh, yeah, and like it or comment or do whatever, rather than on the air, which is just always very fast. It has to be. That's what we do. People want to hear the next song, basically.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, and I think that's interesting because, yeah, they're listening to the radio because they want to be distracted or they want to have something. They want to have music on, right?
I also believe that they want to hear us, you know, and maybe I'm nuts, but I do think that they actually want to hear us too, and they know me a little bit, or they think they do. They do, actually. That they want to hear, you know, how I feel about the what's going to happen weather-wise tomorrow or the snowstorm that's coming or whatever, because I'm going to talk about all that stuff. So yeah, it's not, I don't have the luxury that you do in terms of the time, but I managed to kind of get Ingrid out there.
All right. So that was my short conversation with Ingrid Schumacher as well from CHEM FM. We're going to go now back to our second and final music break. And then Stefan and I have a little bit we want to do here about, I think the appropriate sort of overview would be activism in the sort of global reality of global sort of terror and other stuff like that, and sort of public action and whatnot. So we'll come back and sort of bring the seriousness back up, ratchet it back up, I think, a bit for a minute. But we'll try and end on at least a not super down note. So we'll try and level it out, I think. Stefan's working furiously through the music break here. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, on rabble.ca, and on our wonderful international community radio partners as well. Alex, please tell us what our second and final music break will be.
Yeah, thanks, Darren.
We are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM into the home stretch, last 10 minutes. So Stefan, as we were teasing there, has a little piece he wants to talk about, and I'm going to throw in a couple comments just to finish off the show. But just really quickly before we did that, of course, one of the other things we missed from this morning, it's a news item I got today as I was leaving the house, basically, is that there are now 1,200 firefighters back working around the clock in a growing wildfire again in Southern California, Santa Barbara County. And you've got about 4,000 acres this morning already. Wind is blowing it all over the place really fast. They're now re-evacuating people that have already recently been evacuated due to similar reasons. So I just wanted to sort of point that out because stick a thumbnail in it, because we're just going to point this stuff out as it goes. I think it's super, super important that these things be connected. And I've heard a lot of debate. I don't know if we want to divert any time for this at all, Stefan, but there has been a debate during the Alberta wildfire and since then. And I think it's going to continue to come up about, you know, when and where is the right time and place to point these connections out. In one of the articles you had flagged, actually, there was one Trudeau pointing out. Wait, let's see if I can find it here really fast. Just Trudeau saying about the Alberta fire that, you know, that one event can't be, you know, directly linked to that. And so, well, you know, yes, climate change sort of is going to increase the frequency. Let's not, you know, have a conversation about this other thing based on one. But like, no, but that's the whole point. Every single one is another one. It's not the first fire. It won't be the last fire. And the reason that we need to make this connection was doing something about this problem is going to prevent future fires. And it's like when people say after a shooting that it's not the right time for a conversation about gun violence. But when else is the time to talk about, hey, we know why this happened. We don't want this to happen again. So let's do something about that. And the time to do that is when you have people's attention. Because you know what? When you wait until people lose and think about something else, now they just tune you out again the same way they were before. So I sort of see some of the arguments as to, you know, about why, but I don't agree that it's disrespectful to do that. I think it is respectful of future I think it's extremely respectful to want to prevent future loss of life based on while you have people's attention based on a previous tragedy. I think that's completely legitimate, but I do understand that's controversial. What do you think?
No, I was going to actually use that example to use as a segue with specifically the gun question, right? Because that's exactly what is said every time there's a shooting. Is that this is not the time to politicize about guns. It's not the time to talk about that. And what I wanted to get into is what I'm writing a piece which I'll post hopefully next week at some point, which is just titled Hurricane Sandy Hook, Collective Action in the Age of Terrorism. Mm. Because what happened after the shootings in Orlando was I spent the entire next day just depressed. Which I'm sure everyone did, but I'm not in a place personally to talk about specifically the shooting. So I'm pulling it back a little bit to sort of just the idea of when these sort of divisive actions happen. You can totally they happen all over the place, all the time, in from a massively wide range of people. You know, even just like 2 days ago or 3 days ago, Joe Cox, an MP in Britain, was killed. Well, the person yelled "Britain first" beforehand. And how
it's associated with some super super like far right white supremacist nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and also part of trying to get, you know, the whole the idea of the Britain leaving the EU. And of course, and how different is that than, you know, than calling 911 to pledge allegiance to ISIS? To me, they're the same thing, and they're calls for divisiveness. What scares me the most about these sort of things is whenever an action of this nature happens on any type of these actions, the reaction from so many is to divide. you know, Trump immediately comes out and says that we need to close off our borders, even though the guy was born in America. You know, the idea that
or that a Mexican judge can't do something, even though the fact that he's an American judge.
Exactly. Whenever these actions happen, and terrorism inspires this, people recoil, and in recoiling, they become very tribal in their who's okay, who's not okay thing. Mm. And what's terrifying about this is that when the waves broke ashore on October 29th, 2012, and swept into Manhattan, Hurricane Sandy didn't discriminate. And it wasn't saying like, oh, well, you know, I'm only going after Americans. No, it hit everyone, and everyone had to respond. I use that as a highlight the fact that collective action is hard even at the best of times. And it's been shown over and over again, the power of community is the way to fight climate change, is the way to reduce carbon. And in a local level, community provides opportunities to reduce carbon, through sharing and through the personal networks. On a national level, you need every province in this country to come together to actually agree on some sort of climate plan, so we can actually have some sort of federal plan to move forward. On an international level, we need country people. You know, if you have one leader demonizing an entire like a million people, and then he's not going to go turn around the next day and walk up to them and be like, okay, so how are we going to work together on climate change? That just can't happen. And so what scared me about this reaction, whenever something like this happens, what is really, from an environmental side, what is really concerning is that it's an incredibly divisive language at a time when we really cannot afford it. You know, it's not, we don't have, you know, as I was saying to you during one of the breaks, we don't. If we spend the next 10, 15 years debating national security and debating what's going on between, you know, protecting ourselves from these sort of existential threats of lone wolves and just being scared and hiding in our houses. And because of that, that's what our dom is, our national conversation. And we forget of this looming danger of climate change. Our greatest fear will be imagined. Our greatest fear will be imagined, and that's terrifying to me.
Mm. Well, there's sort of two themes I want to pull out here. One of them is extremely quick and a throwaway, and the other one's more something maybe we can dig into. And I think we'll probably end up carrying this over a little bit. Today's bonus show will be pretty abbreviated, but I think we'll probably end up just sort of carrying this conversation through for a few minutes. But the first thing was, you know, this idea is sort of very much like what you're saying about how. A lot of these problems stem out of this sort of individualistic us versus them sort of mentality. And so whether we're talking about, you know, terrorism or climate change or any of these other things, you know, all these companies are worried about protecting themselves. We have these companies, you know, lying to people, funding nonsense science to confuse the public because they want to protect them and theirs. And at some point they rationalize that this is, well, you know, probably it's some form combination of, well, everyone else is doing it, sort of the Ayn Rand mentality of, you know, I'm only out for myself. You know, it's this idea of projection. Everybody assumes what other people do. Always, you know, always be suspicious of the first person to accuse somebody of stealing something because they're probably the thief, that sort of thing, right? Everybody assumes everyone else is like them because how could they not? Or at least until they get further information. You assume other people are going to be similar to you until you have other information or until another bias inserts itself, right? So maybe a racist person wouldn't assume a Muslim was like them, but that's another bias sort of inserting itself. If you put a person like them, they're going to assume that they're like them all the time, which is why we see these actions and where a lot of that rationalization comes from. But the idea, as you were saying, was that many of these problems come, whether we're talking about sort of business or social or whatever, come from this idea of separating people and pitting people against each other. And, you know, not only is it not constructive as a solution, it's actively part of the problem. So, you know, there's two ways to look at that. One of them is the connection between climate change and extremism, which is that when people don't have food and water, they're much more likely to be able to be convinced to join some death cult, whether it be because they want to live and they genuinely are convinced that their only option of doing that is to fight the only power they see oppressing them, which is, you know, in this case, American drones, or they just give up all hope and think, well, you know, I'll have a better life in this fantasy land some, you know, imam told me existed. And so I'm just going to leave this hellhole of my terrible life and my horrid existence. And if I do this one thing, I'll be glory and celebrated and I'll get us all this attention and love and power and respect that I never had in my real life. And so I think if we understand the roots of these problems, we can actually start to identify them. And so not only, you know, do we need to come together, is that we also have to understand that we can't just not, you know, slander all Muslims with the actions of a few people who happen to be Muslim, not to mention all the non-Muslim terrorism we like to conveniently call lone wolves, but also that the actual solution to these problems is communism, or communalism, sorry, not communism, is communalism in the sense that, you know, if these people weren't starving, if we all had stable economies and a functional education system, we would see these problems be much more manageable. That's all the time we have for on the show. And I have a funny throwaway comment you're going to really wish you'd heard. So please stay tuned, download the podcast to hear what my funny throwaway comment. We're going to toss this idea around a little bit further. And I hopefully Alex will also join in us. But for that, as far as the on-air show, that's all the time we have. Thanks for listening to The Green Majority. Have another good green week, folks, and because it's Pride Month, happy Pride.